Across the Pacifica Network and around the nation, this is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, September 18, 2003. From Chiapas, Mexico, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Texas Democrats are now back home for what many are calling the redistricting showdown. Disability rights activists are protesting Congress's delay of passing the Mi Casa bill that would allow more people with disabilities to live within their own communities instead of a nursing home or other institution. And in Iraq, thousands are being held in American-run detention camps where reports are increasing of human rights violations. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The United States federal government in Washington, D.C. shut down today in anticipation of Hurricane Isabel's arrival. Air Force One, the president's plane, and many other military aircraft were sent inland, while naval ships were sent out to sea to avoid the storm's high winds and heavy rains. Folks in the nation's capital will likely see the bulk of the storm tonight. Isabel has already touched ground in North Carolina, and there are reports of flooding and power outages. As Dave Littman reports from Chapel Hill, many around the state have reason to worry that emergency services will be scarce now and in the aftermath of the hurricane.
As the season's first hurricane blasts ashore in North Carolina, power is going out, schools are closed, 3,000 National Guard are on standby, and residents are being told to stay in their homes. Meanwhile, the Red Cross is appealing for donations because its disaster relief fund is empty. This could make it hard for storm victims whose homes are demolished to find money for first month's rent, furniture, or even cooking utensils. Some North Carolina residents are still suffering from the effects of Hurricane Floyd, which 4 years ago wreaked havoc in the largely poor counties of eastern North Carolina. There have been many complaints of slow or negligible services in the wake of Floyd, and the area has yet to recover from that disaster. In Princeville, a town of 2,000 founded by ex-slaves, almost every house was flooded. The residents work mostly low-paying jobs, and many declined to take out rebuilding loans since they could never pay them back. Many are fearful of a repeat of the post-Floyd neglect in the aftermath of Isabel. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Dave Lippman in North Carolina.
The Florida Bar Association, representing hundreds of state inmates, is seeking another year to conduct DNA testing for their cases before the October 1st deadline. WMNF's Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
Florida is one of 30 states with a law designed to help prison inmates who say they are innocent prove that with DNA testing. But Florida's law, passed in 2001, is only good for 2 years and gives current inmates only until this October to file their DNA motions. Law students and volunteer attorneys have screened nearly 700 cases since 1999, but there's still a backlog of about 500 cases. Catherine Arcabasio is the co-director of the Florida Innocence Project.
The bar is recommending 1 year, but knowing full well that 1 year is clearly not enough. And really my position is that there shouldn't be a time bar on proving that you're innocent.
No one on the backlog list has a death sentence. But since most state prisoners don't have lawyers, records and documents must be collected and reviewed in their cases. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
Wild salmon contaminated by PCBs in the Pacific Northwest arrive in the pristine Alaskan wilderness and deposit the toxin. Andrew Stelzer has more from Portland, Oregon.
Salmon migrating north to spawn absorb high levels of industrial pollutants which are released into the atmosphere and oceans by waste incineration and other industries, according to a study by a researcher at the University of Ottawa. After they lay eggs, these contaminated fish die, releasing the pollutants into the lake sediment. The dead fish become fodder for insects at the bottom of the food chain, creating a snowball effect of toxins spreading throughout the entire animal kingdom, including fish, bears, and eagles. In humans, PCBs suppress the immune system and can cause cancer, reproductive defects, and damage to the nervous system. Jack Hessian with the Sierra Club of Alaska says that the study's important because it shows salmon can be transporters of PCBs, meaning the pollutants are not only a danger to the regions where they are leaked, but even the most remote areas on Earth.
The lakes cited are some of the most important salmon-producing lakes in the world.
The study concluded that the contaminated salmon are safe to eat for humans, but an Alaskan environmental representative said more research is needed to see just how toxic the wild salmon are. For FSRN from Portland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
The head of the New York Stock Exchange resigns after intense pressure over his hefty financial compensation package. Ian Forrest reports from WBAI in New York.
It's official. Richard Grasso, chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, has resigned. This following a meeting of the directors of the exchange yesterday to look into widespread calls for his resignation. At the heart of the matter was Grasso's deferred payment and retirement benefits package, which would see him receiving approximately $140 million, a sum which for many was simply too much. This certainly is what 13 of 20 directors thought when in a vote on his continued stewardship of the exchange, they voted to accept his resignation. And, as is being reported by the New York Times, the board of the exchange has directed Compensation Committee Chairman H. Carl McCall to continue the board's corporate reform, a move which many are skeptical of, especially in light of Grasso's pay package, which had been approved under the watch of the very board in question. For FSRN in New York, I am Ian Forrest.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Democrats have been fighting for several months to thwart Republican efforts to redraw the state's congressional map, saying it would greatly affect minority representation in Congress. Part of the Democrats' efforts to keep the GOP from pushing through its redistricting measures has been a series of direct actions where 53 state senators left the state to avoid being arrested and sent back to Congress. However, the Democrats are now back home for what many are calling the redistricting showdown. Robert Cardenas has more from KPFT in Houston.
In this third special session, Texas legislators are in Austin wrestling with the issue of redistricting. The issue has proved to be so contentious, it inspired walkouts earlier this session to Ardmore, Oklahoma, and New Mexico. But late Tuesday night, the redistricting map passed the House. And with this, the Texas legislature may never be the same. State Representative Jim Dunham.
The elements of cooperation that we had with Laney and W. Bush is totally gone.
Dr. Henry Cuellar, who holds a Ph.D. in government, served for years in the Texas House and later as Secretary of State under Rick Perry. He had an opportunity to work with both men and offers this perspective.
Governor Perry has taken a hard stance, hardball, a very different position from Bush, has taken a different approach. You know, maybe things have changed and the dynamics have changed, but I would say they probably had a different style. And I think that's very evident from what's happening.
Besides the tone of the rhetoric changing, so has the Republican Party's message. For years, Democrats were looked upon as a party helping minority citizens, but the Republicans took a different approach on redistricting. Republican operatives argued that redistricting was good for Texas minorities and that the Democrats had a plantation mentality towards Texas minorities. Ted Royer, spokesperson for the Texas Republican Party, had this to offer.
If you look at the Republican Party record in Texas, we've got a strong record of being an inclusive party. In fact, in the past 10 years, since Republicans have been the majority at the state level, eight minorities have served in statewide office. When the Democrats controlled Texas for 130 years, only five minorities served in elected statewide office. So clearly we're the party with the record of including minorities in top leadership positions.
African-American State Representative Garnett Coleman witnessed something entirely different yesterday.
Bill King admitted, who's the author, he and Joe Crabb, of the redistricting bill, that there is a no net gain of seats for people of color in the House map that was passed yesterday. On the record, on the floor of the House, he said there is no net gain.
Nor does Representative Coleman see this issue ending anytime soon.
This is far from over. It's important for people to understand that there are many more machinations to occur. But no new seats of color will occur under either map. This will go all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And who's to say that this actually does pass in this third special session? The House has left all its options open. And if the bill has to go to a conference committee report, and then a conference committee report has to be passed on both the floor of the House and the floor of the Senate, there is nothing that stops House members from deciding we don't want to provide them with a quorum.
From KPFT in Houston, this is Robert Cardenas for Free Speech Radio News.
A victory for the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community in Canada this week when, by a narrow margin of 137 to 132, the Canadian House of Commons defeated a non-binding motion calling for the definition of marriage to be solely a heterosexual union. The bill follows court decisions in Ontario and British Columbia that legalized gay marriage earlier this year. Quebec courts have reached a similar decision, though they've yet to take effect. Odelia Bay has more from Toronto.
Michael Leshner and Michael Stark are the self-proclaimed poster boys for gay marriage in Canada. On June 10th, the couple legally wed, just hours after the highest court in the province of Ontario ruled that it is unconstitutional to deny gays and lesbians the right to marry. This followed a similar decision made in the province of British Columbia in May. For the Michaels, as they're sometimes called, marriage was the final frontier.
When we took up the challenge, it was more because we couldn't get married, and marriage was the last legal hurdle that gays and lesbians had to conquer. Symbolically, it was just very important for us to see our path come to its natural conclusion.
Aren't you supposed to say at some point that you loved me
well, that too.
And wanted to spend a whole lifetime together?
But we would have done that. I never thought we'd ever be able to marry.
But the struggle for same-sex marriage in Canada isn't over yet. On Tuesday, Canada's federal representatives voted on a motion to reaffirm a heterosexist definition of marriage. The motion was put forward by the opposition party, the Canadian Alliance, and stated that marriage is and should remain the union of one man and one woman to the exclusion of all others. And it called on Parliament to take all the necessary steps to preserve the traditional meaning, including possibly using a clause in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms to override the courts. The Alliance, led by Stephen Harper, argued that the motion was about the ability of elected officials to make social value judgments over that of the courts. For the Liberal government, it was about human rights. Martin Cochon is the Minister of Justice.
We do believe in religious freedoms and at the same time equality, right, Mr. Speaker? And this is exactly what we are fighting for today as a society.
The vote was very close.
Yes, pour 132, 132. Nays, contre 137, 137.
The split in the House of Commons closely matches the divide in Canadian public opinion. Two recent polls suggest that a slim majority of people support same-sex unions. Lori Aaron is the director of advocacy with EGAL Canada, an organization dedicated to struggling for homosexual equality.
There are more supporters than opponents of this legislation, but so far the supporters have been relatively quiet, and I think that's going to change. And I think the message to take from the vote is that supporters of equal marriage for same-sex couples need to make their voices heard if we're going to win this.
On October 6th, the Canadian Supreme Court will hear a motion put forward by the Catholic Church and others to allow for an appeal of the Ontario and BC court rulings, an action supported by the Vatican. The government is currently writing legislation to codify gay and lesbian marriage, a bill they hope will be ready to be put to a vote by next summer. But until then, Canadians face the possibility of a federal election in which Stephen Harper and the Alliance promise to make homosexual matrimony a key issue. Michael Leshner, who is an activist and a prosecuting attorney, known as a crown attorney in Canada, isn't worried about once again taking on the religious and political right.
I'm fond of saying it may sound egotistical, but Michael Leshner has never lost a legal battle on gay and lesbian rights. I am supremely confident that in Canada, if it's Stephen Harper versus Michael Leshner or the Michaels or gays and lesbians, we'll win hands down.
For Free Speech Radio News in Toronto, I'm Odelia Bay.
Over 200 people, most of whom use wheelchairs, yesterday finished a 144-mile march to the nation's capital in Washington, D.C., that began in Philadelphia 2 weeks ago. Disability rights activists are protesting Congress's delay of passing the Mi Casa bill that would allow more people with disabilities to live within their own communities instead of a nursing home or other institution. Mitch Jeserich reports from D.C.
Some call us disabled, while some call us worse.
Over 200 people with wheelchairs, walkers, crutches, and canes marched to the U.S. Capitol Wednesday afternoon
where they were met by several hundred more protesters demanding that Congress pass a bill to give people with severe disabilities the option of living in their own homes and in their own communities rather than being institutionalized in a nursing home. Todd Gatewood, with Self-Advocates Becoming Empowered, speaks by using an electronic speech board.
For our 11 long years, I was locked in a nursing facility, which wasn't a pretty sight. But today I'm free. We are here today to send a message to Capitol Hill that we are demanding change in the system where our brothers and sisters can be free. To quote the great Dr. King, I have a dream that our brothers and sisters will be free. A dream that there will be no more institutional bias across this country of ours, and finally, a dream that one day our brothers and sisters will be fully included in society.
Under the Medicaid system, the federal government requires states to provide nursing home care for people who need assistance with daily living needs. However, it does not require states to offer the same types of services for people who want to live at home. Bob Liston is with the advocacy group ADAPT, which organized the 144-mile march and is known for its acts of civil disobedience.
There's 2 million people who are being warehoused in nursing homes and other institutions for this simple reason that they have a disability. We need to have a safety net of home care, personal care for people so that they can live in their own home, not be forced into these institutions.
Disability rights activists consider access to home care services a basic civil right in order to participate in a democratic society that claims everyone is equal under the law. Democratic Congressman James Langevin of Rhode Island is a co-sponsor of the MiCasa bill. He also has a personal stake in the matter as he uses a motorized wheelchair and relies on home care services.
You know, every day I get up at 5 or 6 in the morning, get ready for work, and it takes me about 3 hours, and that's with the assistance of a home health aide and then getting in an accessible van and heading off to work in the United States Congress. Well, I'm one of the lucky ones because I can afford these things. But let me tell you, if I couldn't, I wouldn't be here right now, because you can't get to Congress if you can't get out of bed.
With an unemployment rate well over 50%, most people with disabilities cannot afford to pay for their own home care services. The MiCasa bill has been stalled since 1997 due to aggressive lobbying by the nursing home industry. Anita Cameron, who marched from Philadelphia to Capitol Hill, is appalled that the Bush administration is ready to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on war, yet is concerned that the MiCasa bill would cost too much money.
I sometimes wonder how these officials would feel if all of a sudden they woke up one day and they were poor or middle class and they weren't rich and they couldn't afford, you know, to get the care that their family needed. If they woke up one day and was a person like myself, I don't understand how our government can be so heartless. That's why I think this whole thing in Iraq, it's a hypocrisy.
The MiCasa bill has not become a partisan issue. There are both Republicans and Democrats in support and opposition to it. Disability activists say breaking that deadlock could require backing from the White House. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich on Capitol Hill.
People in Jammu and Kashmir will join the cellular world as this week mobile phones become available for the first time in the troubled regions. Mobile phones have been banned in Indian-administered Kashmir because the Indian government classified them as a security hazard. The service starts this week, despite the recent surge in violence in Kashmir, the excuse the Indian government has been using for not allowing the cellular technology into Kashmir. Shahnawaz Khan reports from Srinagar.
Mobile phones came to India in 1995, and in these 8 years, people were swayed by the revolution. With operators competing to consumers' delight, the mobiles are no longer the property of elites in India. But for the people of Jammu and Kashmir, the service remained elusive so far. Arun Kumar is the Chief General Manager Telecom for Jammu and Kashmir.
Actually, mobile service was not permitted in J&K state. It was opened up by Government of India in August 2002. But for the state of J&K, because elections were going to be held, So they directed us to start the work only in November 2000.
We have still not got permission for many of the places. Baramulla, we are radiating power. The system is ready, but the presently permission is not there.
Mobile service started in selected pockets specified by the government. Areas deemed sensitive will continue to remain without the facility, though telecom officials feel they would get the clearance for other areas too.
We have started the services first in three places, in Jammu, Srinagar, and the Katra Vaishno Devi route. And by, we'll be able to start the services in other places in J&K. This is only a beginning, and as and when we start getting clearances, the services will continue in other parts of this particular state.
India has been very sensitive to the misuse of communication facilities by guerrillas in the state. In February 2001, the government withdrew STD, ISD and internet facilities from the state for about 3 months. Lines to Pakistan, Afghanistan and a few other countries remain snapped all the time because of security consideration. Many, however, believe these measures are useless. Akmal is a businessman in Srinagar.
Well, I think it wasn't any reason because militants, they have their own communication and very strong communication. They have their own sets, walkie-talkies, so it wouldn't have made any difference earlier also. So maybe they have realized this now. So,
with the situation in Kashmir still volatile, it's hard to say what made India rethink its decision. Wajahat is a journalist working with a Srinagar-based newspaper.
I think India has been overreacting and depriving people of Kashmir from basic facilities like a cell phone. Earlier they said there were security considerations. Now, I want to ask, what has changed? The attacks are still taking place. It's only they want to show to the world that everything has changed. It's just a political gimmick.
The Bharat Sanchar Nigam Limited, or BSNL, held a computerized draw to decide the fate of around 45,000 applicants for 26,000 SIM cards available in the first phase in Jammu and Srinagar. But not everyone is excited about the service. Fahin is a scholar at the University of Kashmir.
We need drinking water, we need schools, we need hospitals. So invest there. Why invest in a service which the common people won't benefit from?
Still, some feel mobiles are a necessity in the troubled region. Shamima is a housewife in Srinagar.
Here the situation is volatile. When children go out and when we hear something has happened, we remain tense until our children return. Now at least we can give them a call to know if they are safe.
The BSNL also provides the basic telephone facilities in the state, and it has yet to provide landline telephones to all its applicants. Some of which have been waiting for the last 3 years feel the mobile telephony is a political slogan meant only for the elite. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
President Bush has admitted there is no link between Saddam Hussein and the September 11 attacks, one of the prominent reasons for the war in Iraq. Bush told reporters, quote, "We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with September the 11th. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting today that Defense Department officials say that the U.S.'s most formidable foe in Iraq in the months ahead may be the resentment of ordinary Iraqis due to their increasing hostility to the American military occupation. The Times went on to say that the defense officials spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were concerned about retribution for straying from the official line. This is Iraqis whose family members are being held at American-run detention camps are facing daily worries and distress over the stories they hear of what's happening inside those facilities. Thousands of Iraqi detainees and prisoners of war are being held captive in American-run prisons, where critics say human rights violations are occurring on a daily basis. FSRN correspondent in Baghdad, Ahmed Al-Rawi, reports.
There are now three main detention facilities in Iraq, where more than 5,000 Iraqi detainees are held. The first one is the infamous airport camp, the second is Qasr detention camp, and the third one is Abu Ghraib prison, that holds more than 500 detainees. Iraqis are now detained for different reasons. The first and most common one is the possession of banned weapons, going out during night curfew, being a senior member of the former ruling Ba'ath Party, accused of committing a crime against humanity and other crimes. But there are many innocents inside these detention camps. Uday, for example, is a 32-year-old man who prefers that his last name not to be used on the radio. He was detained in the Baghdad International Airport camp, where he says he was treated very badly. Here is his story.
They don't let us wash ourselves very often, so we become infected with scabies. Usually they'll give you water, but no soap. What's the use when you're in the midst of such hot weather? We were desperate for cold water and cigarettes, but the usual answer was no. There is neither electricity nor water, except a bottle occasionally. We can't wash ourselves to pray, and if we want, we have to use the only bottle of drinking water they give to us to clean ourselves so as to pray. Our cells were like an animal stockade. We are animals in their eyes, and this is the way that they have been ordered to treat us.
45-year-old Abu Qasim sold electronics equipment in a small store in Baghdad. He says American soldiers confiscated all his goods, and he was taken away as a detainee on a false claim.
The room in the prison had no fans or cooling system and was without water or food. They even held children in the Fifth Sector prison. Some as young as 12 or 13 years old were put in isolation. They didn't commit any crimes. They were just brought to the prisons with their fathers. Some were barefoot and put in cells only 1 meter by 2 meters. In the airport detention camp, some were beaten to death. 2 days before my arrival, one detainee was killed as a result of his beating. Female American soldiers tortured the detainees with sand. They made the detainees remain half buried in the burning sand for 5 to 6 hours.
Amnesty International has also showed its concern for the condition of the detention camps and the treatment Iraqi detainees receive by the American detaining authorities. Dr. Saeed Boumamdouha is Amnesty International's representative in Iraq.
The most common methods is to keep detainees exposed to the sun for many, many hours. We met with a number of former detainees who have been released, and they told us about the very, very tough conditions, and they are not given enough water, they are not given enough food. Immediately after arrest, they put plastic bags on their heads for a few hours. Sometimes it's quite suffocating in this heat. Their hands are tied behind their backs with very, very tight plastic kind of rope. The fact that some of them are beaten up, put on the ground. They are kept lying on the ground for some time. Sometimes brutally, with the soldiers having their feet on their necks.
Along with the failure of the American administration to restore security and essential services to Iraq, nearly 5 months into the occupation, as well as the ongoing accidental killings of Iraqi civilians by U.S. military forces, the treatment of detainees is fostering negative attitudes among average Iraqis towards the American occupation and towards the United States in general. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ahmed Al-Rawi in Baghdad.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at WBAI by Kata Mesta. Headlines editors from WMNF in Tampa, Florida are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abrams. Technical producers at KPFA in Berkeley are Jade Padgett-Seekins and Pauline Bartolone. I'm Deepa Fernandez.